session, Judges Gaetis, Larkin, and Cochran, with the Honorable Theodora Gaetis presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second oral argument on our calendar today. The case is Michelle Antoinette Frison, and on behalf of the minor child, versus Hermias Mesfin Asfaw, case number A20-1423. Just a few remarks before we get started with your arguments, counsel. We are recording the arguments this morning using the Zoom platform. We're on Zoom due to the pandemic. The recording of the argument will be available very shortly on our court's website. I would ask anyone else who is observing and the attorneys to not make independent recordings of the arguments. As to the case, you can both assume that we've had the opportunity to read your briefs and that the court is familiar with the facts of the case and the legal issues that are raised here. The appellant will have 15 minutes for argument. The respondent will also have 15 minutes, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I just ask both attorneys to please identify yourselves before you begin your arguments. And with that, I will turn to counsel for the appellant. You may proceed.
Thank you. Thomas Sieben on behalf of the appellant. And may it please the court and counsel for the respondent, thank you for this opportunity. This case deals with difficult subject matter. It's heart-wrenching to talk about injuries sustained by a child, but the legal and factual issues before this court are simple issues. We have evidentiary issues and we have burden of proof issues in this case. As far as the evidentiary issues, hearsay is something that this court needs to consider. I objected at the district court level numerous times on a basis of hearsay. However, the witness was allowed to testify to the medical conditions of another person that she could only have heard from a doctor or some type of medical professional. Respondent has claimed that these statements at the district court level by the witness do not constitute hearsay. However, they were statements made by another person and they were offered for the truth of the matter asserted. The Order for Protection statute 518B allows for the issuance of an order for protection if bodily injury is proven up. And that's why the statements, yes.
Ms. Larkin with a question here. I wonder if that matters. As I understand it, she testified regarding what the specific injuries were. And the argument is, well, she obviously heard that from a doctor, so it's hearsay. But she also testified regarding her observation of the child's legs before she took him to the doctor, her observation of the child's legs in a cast coming out of the medical facility and the need for the child to be on painkillers. Doesn't all of that evidence support a finding that there was bodily harm to the child without necessarily having to know exactly what the fractures were or what the medical diagnosis was?
Right, Your Honor. A layperson obviously has the ability to testify to what they observe in any manner. And she certainly was able to testify that the legs were swollen before going to the doctor and that she did see the child in some type of cast. She laid no foundation as to how she knew that the child was being administered any type of medication, and obviously no foundation as to how she knew that there were broken bones.
Doesn't the record show that the child was prescribed medication? And so she, as the parent, would be providing the medication?
At the time of this hearing, she was still not a custodial person for the child. So it's unclear. I asked the court on page 12 of the transcript, I asked the court to direct the witness to state why she knew of the conditions, which would have included how the medication. However, that request was not complied with in this situation.
But you're not suggesting, are you, that her testimony that the child had swollen legs going into medical care and then came out of medical care with his legs in a cast is insufficient to show bodily harm without attendant testimony explaining exactly what the injuries were?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. You're absolutely right with that. However, allowing the witness to testify to the number of broken bones in general and the number and the manner or the places where they were alleged to have been gives it quite a bit more weight.
And okay, but at the end of the day, we need a preponderance of the evidence of bodily harm. And I mean, so even if we take out all of her testimony about, well, here's where the fractures were and the number of fractions, we still have evidence of bodily harm to this child.
Yes.
So if there is a hearsay error, it's harmless.
I do not believe it's harmless because, as I said at the beginning, when you're talking about injuries to a child, it has an impact that it wouldn't have if we're talking about injuries to an adult. It brings up an emotional era. It's hard to take that out of a decision maker's mind. So it does definitely have a prejudicial effect when we talk about the types of injuries that were testified.
So your argument is anytime there's evidence regarding injury to a child, it's prejudicial? I don't understand your argument.
My argument is that allowing somebody without the basis to testify to broken bones and the number of broken bones in the places was an error, and that is prejudicial.
I guess I'm going to have to disagree with you. I'm having a hard time understanding how it's prejudicial. If you concede that her testimony that the child's legs were swollen and then the child's legs were in a cast afterwards shows bodily harm. I mean, bodily harm is any pain or discomfort, however slight. It would seem to me if we have a child with both legs in a cast, that would, you know, probably as a matter of law, establish bodily harm without the need for any additional testimony regarding the specific nature of the injuries.
You're right there. However, it does inflame some passions when we talk about 10 broken toes, 2 broken legs, broken skull, and things of that nature.
But this wasn't tried to a jury, it's tried to the district court. I mean, a district court judge is trained not to be influenced by those sorts of prejudices and passions. I guess your argument would have more strength if this were a jury trial. Sorry.
I'll move along. Regardless,
I have one follow-up question, Judge Cochran here. There isn't any indication in the district court's order that it relied in any way on the specific nature of the injuries as identified by the doctor, is there? In other words, there's no basis to conclude that the district court relied on what you are arguing is hearsay in reaching its conclusion.
You're correct. As happens in a lot of these, and as you all know from reviewing them, there's oftentimes not an extensive findings of fact with this order. So you're absolutely right with that.
I just have a question as well. Was the district court entitled to, and is this court entitled to also consider the petition that was submitted in application for the order for protection?
The district court did not indicate that they did that in this particular case. I've never seen a case from your court or the Supreme Court that allows that to be considered when making findings of facts or an ultimate ruling at the conclusion of an order for protection. If that answers your question. What we have here is the witness did testify to material issues here being the broken bones. It is hearsay that should have been sustained and should not have been allowed. The respondent in their brief argues to the court, first of all, it's not hearsay, but in the very next page of their brief, the alternative argument they offer is that if you find it is hearsay, you should allow it into evidence as residual hearsay under Rule 807. So it's similar to somebody saying, I didn't punch my neighbor. However, if you think I did punch my neighbor, it was self-defense. Those alternative arguments given to this court diminish the credibility of each of those arguments. When addressing residual hearsay, the court first has to find whether or not it is a material fact. Respondent concedes in page 15 of their brief that the testimony to the medical condition of the child was a material fact. Respondent in their brief claims that it should be admitted because it meets the other criteria for residual hearsay. And the third criteria is that there's no other reasonable grounds for that testimony to come in. Respondent indicates that their client was not able to afford having people come in and testify. However, subpoenas are free in order for protection cases. By statute, a witness is only entitled to a $20 fee for their testimony in any type of civil case like this. Respondent herself testified during the hearing that she works and she's able to pay her bills. There was no finding of indigency, and even if there was, we're only talking about a $20 fee to have somebody come in and testify. Additionally, residual hearsay would not allow for these statements to come in because the criteria of notice to us was not met. The argument that respondent covers in their brief that notice was met by simply the petition and the affidavit is not sufficient under the rule of evidence because, as this court knows, the rules of evidence require that they would have had to have told us the name, address, location, and present whereabouts of the declarant of the statement, which obviously was not happened, and residual hearsay was never argued at the district court in this case. This individual, we talked about the foundation that she would have in order to testify about the cast or any swelling of the legs. Regarding the burden of proof issue in this case, there was not a preponderance of the evidence that the appellant committed domestic abuse as defined by the statute. This Minnesota Supreme Court has stated an order for protection is available only if the petitioner shows that appellant committed domestic abuse against petitioner or the person on whose behalf the petition is brought. That's, as this court knows, in State versus Croons, which was a 2012 decision. Now, the order for protection statute 518B, it does loosen up the definition of domestic assault compared to what we would use in a criminal court. So it does loosen it up. However, it still requires that version of domestic assault be proven, that definition be proven. That definition in 518B requires physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, or the infliction of fear or imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, if committed against a family or household member by a family or household member. Here, the respondent has argued that we've failed to present any type of evidence to contradict their claims. However, cross-examination is presentation of evidence. I did cross-examine the witness. That does constitute presentation of evidence. We did establish the timeline and the version of events. And I know this court has read the transcript, so knows the version of events and access to the child prior to this incident.
Mr. Stevens, speaking of access to the child, would you agree that the record shows that father, mother, and grandmother all had access to the child within the 24 hours prior to the child going to the hospital?
Yes.
And the record shows that father was arrested, but mother and grandmother were not, and there was no objection to that testimony.
Correct. And there was no statement as to what the arrest was for or what the criminal charge against the appellant was for. There was no statement as to what stage in the proceeding that criminal charge is. And as this court knows, that means there's no indication that it had gone past an omnibus hearing where there would be a declaration of probable cause. And as this court knows, there are many charges that could be brought in a criminal case, including neglect or endangerment. And the Court of Appeals has decided that neglect or endangerment by itself is not sufficient to issue an order for protection. So therefore, any testimony about a criminal charge against appellant in this case does not carry weight to allow for the issuance of an order for protection. It's not simply just a substitute for a district court's analysis and decision.
Well, with regard to the nature of the charges, I believe that the petition indicates that sorry, I have to find the exact language here. That appellant was charged with first degree bodily assault and bodily harm. Assuming we can consider the petition, isn't that sufficient to support the district court's conclusion, which was basically, as I recall, that you know, given that one of the three individuals is responsible for the injury and there is only evidence of there's no evidence of mother or grandmother being involved in the injury and the only evidence relates to father, why isn't there a preponderance of evidence that father is the one who's responsible for the injury?
First of all, I think we'll be taking a leap if this court decides that you can consider the affidavit as evidence to support the district court's order after a hearing where there was no testimony regarding that or the specifics of the charge. Second, the filing of a complaint is not subject to any type of meaningful scrutiny, much less an omnibus hearing, even just a perfunctory omnibus hearing where a district court considers probable cause. Third, there's never been a determination by this court that probable cause in a criminal case does constitute preponderance of the evidence to issue an order for protection.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Seaman, it looks like your time is up. You will have the opportunity to address us again during rebuttal. Now we're going to hear from counsel for the respondent, Ms. Miller.
May it please the court, my name is Brittany Miller of the law firm Moss & Barnett, and I represent the respondent, Michelle Frizon. And just for ease of reference, and so that I'm not mispronouncing anyone's last names, I will be using mother and father to describe the parties throughout my argument. So just to reorient the court, because I think there's been a lot of conversation about criminal law and standards in criminal law, this is a civil order for protection case. As this court is well aware, the district court has extremely broad discretion in order for protection cases. And when interpreting and enforcing the Minnesota Domestic Abuse Act 518B01, the district court is supposed to give it liberal construction in favor of the injured party. And that's because the purpose and the overall goal of that statute is to protect and prevent family violence, which is exactly what we have in this case. And it involves a two-month-old infant, so a nonverbal child, 2 months old. First, I think it would be helpful just to, once again, before I address the testimony and evidence that is in dispute, to really just summarize the evidence that's not in dispute. The best place to look for that is the district court judge's own summary. So contrary to what father's attorney has argued, there were extensive findings of fact. They were oral findings of fact at the end of the evidentiary hearing. On page 38 of the transcript, the judge in this case goes through exactly what evidence she was basing her decision off of to issue the order for protection. And you'll note that nowhere in that summary does she reference the specific injuries, the broken toes, the two broken legs, the fractured skull, all of those injuries that have been argued are prejudicial and shouldn't have been considered. That wasn't a basis for her issuance of the order for protection. It wasn't in her oral findings and it wasn't in the actual written order for protection. So the evidence, excuse me, that was not in dispute.
Can I ask a question, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
What, I mean, in terms of the evidence presented, there's evidence that father was the only one charged with a criminal offense and involved in a child protection proceeding. What does the record provide in terms of explaining what the criminal charge was about and what the child protection case was about? In other words, what in the record says he was charged with a crime based on these injuries to the child? Same for the child protection case. What evidence connects that?
Thank you, Your Honor. So first, I think that this court can connect the dots. There was a criminal investigation as soon as this child was brought to the hospital and his injuries were known. The criminal investigation only results in father being arrested. It only results in father having a domestic abuse no contact order issued against him that prohibits him from having any contact with the child. That all came about directly after this child was seen at the hospital.
And that's all in the record?
That is all testified to in the record. So even if this court doesn't look at the petition, which was used to grant the ex parte order for protection, this court can look at mother's testimony. And I laid it out in her brief that explains exactly where in the transcript she's testifying. Look, he's the one with the Danko. Myself and maternal grandmother don't have a Danko against us. We were cleared by law enforcement. In terms of the child protection case, father is the only one that has an open case against him, which he conceded. He's also the only one who has no connection or no visitation rights with the child. Mother has a case plan, and her parenting time is slowly increasing, which she also testified to. There was never any child protection investigation or case plan with the maternal grandmother, and no restrictions on her ability to have contact with the child.
I have a question, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Sieben to pay attention to the question because I'd like him to address it on rebuttal as well. You know, the record is clear that there was a Danko related to the child's injury, prohibiting father from seeing child, which would have arisen in father's criminal case, which ties the criminal case to father. It's my understanding that for a Danko, it can be based merely on the existence of the criminal charge. In other words, probable cause for the crime supports issuance of a Danko. So I'm wondering why, if probable cause for a crime of domestic violence supports issuance of a Danko, probable cause wouldn't be sufficient for issuance of an order for protection. Can you address that?
Well, I think that it's just because there are different standards, and I think the bar is even lower in the civil order for protection realm.
But well, I agree with you, and that's why I'm asking why we wouldn't be okay. I mean, I understand that probable cause is a lower standard of preponderance of the evidence, but if we're willing to say probable cause supports the issuance of a Danko in a criminal case where the burdens are normally higher, the standards are higher, and that violation of a Danko could be a crime, why wouldn't we accept a probable cause determination as sufficient for issuance of an order for protection in the civil case where the standards are generally lower, and even though violation of the OFP could be a crime? I'm having a hard time, I guess, in my mind, seeing a difference between a domestic abuse no contact order and an order for protection, and wondering why, if probable cause, that is the existence of a criminal charge, supports one, it's insufficient to support the other.
I think that you can rely on the Danko, and I'm arguing that it would be sufficient, but I think that there's plenty of evidence in addition to it that this court should focus on. The mother testified explicitly about what she observed. She was at the hospital for 9 hours without seeing her two-month-old son because he was getting x-rays and tests done. When she saw him again, he was getting intravenous fluids and had pain medication. Months later, when she was testifying at this hearing, she testified that he was still recuperating, still needed to be careful when they were transporting him, and on two seizure medications. And that was months after all these incidents occurred at the hospital. So she provided more than sufficient evidence to say something clearly happened to this child.
What evidence shows that father is responsible? And related to that, is it a preponderance of the evidence standard that we apply? Going back to Judge Larkin's question, or is there any case that suggests that probable cause is sufficient?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, it is the preponderance of the evidence standard. We're tied to the Domestic Abuse Act, the statute which outlines the elements that have to be proven. And the evidence that father is the one that committed this, obviously it was a two-month-old child who can't speak and can't say who did this. And so this court has to infer from who was around the child, who was giving care to the child at the time, that something happened and he's the one that committed it. And there's plenty of case law cited in the brief that of respondent that says this court can make that inference, because this is going to be an issue that always comes up if you have a nonverbal child who can't explain what happened. So this court is able to connect the dots. It's able to say, look, these were the three people caring for the child. Of the three, only one has been charged criminally. Only one has a child protection case open against him. Only one has a history of domestic abuse. This was a case where he conceded he committed domestic abuse against mother. So with all of that evidence in total, I think that there is sufficient evidentiary support for the order for protection. In terms of, one moment.
Does it matter that the standard for a criminal charge is probable cause in terms of meeting the preponderance of the evidence standard?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we have a preponderance of the evidence. If you look at everything together, including mother's testimony, which the court found credible, she testified she's concerned that father or about father having the child in his care. She believes father did this, and she is concerned that the child wouldn't be safe with him. So the court can rely on her safety concerns as well to issue the order for protection. And to, again, say out of the three people who were caring for this child, it's more likely than not, which is the standard, that father is the one who committed the acts of domestic abuse. So turning to the evidence that is in dispute, which again, I don't even think this court has to consider because there's enough undisputed evidence. And again, I'll point out that appellant father chose not to testify, chose not to provide his own evidence. Cross-examination, if it is evidence, fine, but the court didn't find father credible because he didn't take the stand. The court found mother credible. So I think that it looks like it was a legal strategy not to have father testify that didn't pay off. And now he's coming to this court and complaining that the evidence is insufficient when there is more than enough here to issue an order for protection. But looking at the evidence that is in dispute, yes, there are alternate arguments made. At the trial court, mother's attorney said this evidence, this testimony is not hearsay. It's just being provided to provide some context as to why there were child protection cases and criminal investigations after this child went to the hospital. This is my understanding of the child's injuries. She didn't provide a medical opinion or expert testimony. This was her layperson's understanding of what happened to her son. So if the court disagrees with that argument and is looking for a hearsay exception, I do believe this falls within the residual hearsay exception. Appellant's counsel raised an issue that the petition for the order for protection is insufficient notice under 807 to provide notice that she's going to be testifying about out-of-court statements. This court, in an non-precedential opinion, actually said the opposite, that a petition for an order for protection could provide notice. And what's interesting in this case is that as soon as mother was about to testify, father's attorney interjected and said, I anticipate what she's going to say is X, Y, Z, because that's what she said in her petition. And those are all out-of-court statements. So they were very much aware that mother was going to be testifying about the child's injuries, just as she had done and laid them out in her petition. And the case where a petition for an order for protection provided notice under 807 rules of evidence was Wall v. Wall. It's a 2010 case, and the case number is A10-634. So I do think if the court wants to consider the specific injuries, all of this child's toes were broken, his head was fractured, his legs were broken, all of that, I think this court can. And I've laid out, again, either why it's not hearsay, which would be the argument, or alternatively, if there has to be an exception, it does fall within the residual hearsay exception. And if the court has no other questions, then I think I will conclude my argument. Again, Ms. Frizon is requesting that this court affirm the order for protection. Thank you.
Ms. Miller, can you briefly address Mr. Sieben's argument that that mother could have subpoenaed a doctor to testify?
Yes.
I think in your brief, you argue that she didn't have the financial means to do so.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, the trial court attorney made that argument on the record and said that this was an expense issue. I know her trial attorney worked for a nonprofit that represented her at no cost. So I think the idea was, you know, there's a lot of attorney's fees that go into subpoenaing witnesses, getting them to testify, bringing that evidence to court. And I think everyone acknowledged that this was a pretty bare bones evidentiary hearing just because of the circumstances surrounding it. So I would disagree that just because mother is working and, you know, the cost of the subpoena might be low, there are other expenses and costs associated with calling witnesses and preparing for what is essentially a miniature trial, that is the order for protection evidentiary hearing. So I think that this was the best mother could do in terms of the evidence she could procure, which is another reason I think we meet that criteria under 807.
Okay, I don't see any other questions. Do you have anything else that you would like to add, Ms. Miller?
No, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. And now we'll go back to counsel for the appellant. Mr. Seaman, do you wish to give a rebuttal argument?
I'll start out by trying to address Judge Larkin's question, and I'll apologize if I don't address it specifically, or happy for some correction on the question. I believe the question was, since there was testimony that there was a Danko as the result of a criminal charge, shouldn't that be enough for the district court in Ramsey County to have considered and allow for a finding of domestic assault in the order for protection? If that's the question, that's what I will try to answer. Yes.
Let me just a little bit more nuance. What I'm wondering in my head is, if standards in criminal cases are supposed to be higher in terms of burdens of proof than in civil cases, and in the criminal arena, a Danko may be issued based solely on the existence of the criminal charge, which is based on probable cause, why would we, in the civil context, conclude that an order for protection should not be issued based on the same criminal charge? And I mean, I get that probable cause is a lower standard than preponderance of the evidence, but I'm just having a hard time understanding how probable cause justifies an order prohibiting contact, which could subject you to criminal charges if it's violated, and an order in the civil context providing the same. It's really the same type of order for the same reason with the same potential criminal consequences. I'm having a hard time understanding why we would accept probable cause in the criminal context as a basis for that order, but not accept it in the civil context. So I don't know if it's a matter of, well, if there's a Danko, there's automatically an OFP, as opposed to, well, if the evidence, if the record shows that dad's been charged with a crime alleging that he caused these injuries, is that good enough to grant an OFP?
Fair question. That's a fair question because there is no case directly on point with that. The closest I could find, Your Honor, is a case that was cited in the briefs. It's an unpublished, so we're now referring to them as unpresidential, 2015 Court of Appeals case in Gasper, G-A-S-P-E-R versus Gasper. In that case, the Court of Appeals decision does reference a pending criminal charge against the respondent at the district court level in that case. However, it does go on to state that the petitioner at the district court level stated that she wanted the OFP because following the state's decision to charge the respondent, his anger escalated. So therefore, my interpretation was the criminal charge was relevant because that elevated his anger propensity towards violence. But again, that was an unpublished case. And again, in that case, the district court level petitioner submitted 91 pages of documentation to the district court to substantiate her claim. So there has never been a finding of what you're asking before. As the respondents counsel here said, this was basically a bare bones evidentiary hearing, but it still matters. If you want to talk about real bare bones, then we talk about the Danko proceedings at a first appearance or an arraignment in a criminal case, because that's a situation where there really is no advance notice or really is no ability to prepare or present testimony to a district court judge prior to issuing or denying that Danko. So there's just not a meaningful review at that, like there's supposed to be at an order for protection hearing, and adherence to the rules of evidence at an order for protection hearing, and specifically adherence to the hearsay and residual hearsay exception, which respondent counsel never specifically answered how they provided us notice of name of the individual, address of the individual, locating criteria of the individual, which is required by the rules of evidence in this case. I hope that's an adequate answer to this court's question.
It is, thank you. Could you address the argument made by respondents' counsel that preponderance of the evidence means more likely than not? And if the record shows that this child had some injury, set aside what it was, the degree, and only three people had access to the child, only one of those people was charged with a crime and involved in a child protection case, doesn't that establish that it's more likely than not that it was dad and not one of these two other people?
That's not what the evidence shows in this case. The people that testified about access to the child testified about access to the child from the night before until the day of the bringing the child to the hospital. So I believe it's June 24th of 2020 through June 25th of 2020. But as the district court judge herself stated in justifying her ruling, these are injuries that could have been sustained prior to that. There was not testimony about whether or not this child goes to a daycare, whether or not an aunt takes care of the child, whether or not the appellant in this case had ever been left alone with the child. Or if anybody else, all we know that was left alone with the child from the record is the maternal grandmother. That's all we know.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Steven. I see that your time is up. Are there any other questions from the other panel members? Okay, I'm seeing none. So I just want to thank both counsel for your very helpful briefs and arguments today. The case is now submitted to us, and we will be issuing a written decision within the statutory timeframe. This also ends the oral argument session this morning. We will now adjourn the proceeding to consider our non-oral cases, and thanks to all.
Thank you.